hppodcraft.com.
Dr. Copper rose wearily from the bunk and washed the hypodermic carefully. The little tinkles it made seemed loud in the packed room now that Blair's gurgling laughter had finally quieted. Copper looked toward Gary and shook his head slowly. "Hopeless, I'm afraid. I don't think we can ever convince him the thing is dead now." Norris laughed uncertainly. "I'm not sure you can convince me. Oh, damn you, MacReady." "MacReady?" Commander Gary turned to look from Norris to MacReady curiously. "The nightmares," Norris explained. "He had a theory about the nightmares we had at the secondary station after finding that thing." "And that was?" Gary looked at MacReady levelly. Norris answered for him, jerkily, uneasily. "That the creature wasn't dead. Had a sort of enormously slowed existence, an existence that permitted it nonetheless to be vaguely aware of the passing of time, of our coming, after endless years. I had a dream it could imitate things."
That was from the opening of Chapter 7 of John Campbell's Who Goes There, the story that my favorite horror film, The Thing, was based off of. So far, I am blown away by how similar the movie is to the original story.
Yeah, I see that. The only thing, I don't understand why Carpenter left out the underwear subplot. Because to me, that's what's really great about this story. There's the monster and the frozen wastelands and the paranoia. Mm-hmm. But underneath all that, there's this mystery. Somebody is not wearing underwear in this group. And the mystery never gets solved, which is what makes this a true weird tale. A weird tale we're covering, by the way, on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Here at hppodcraft.com, I am Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. Reading for us as we wrap up 2017 is the master of making words sound good, Mr. Andrew Lehman.
So glad to have him back. Please go over and grab The Rats in the Walls from CthulhuLives.org. It is amazing.
Always amazing stuff from Dark Adventure Radio Theater. They've also recently put out The Haunter of the Dark. It's good stuff. Go check it out. Make a New Year's resolution. Talk less, listen more. Listen to us, listen to them.
Yeah.
Keep your ears open.
Open them.
And put good stuff in it.
So we left off with some guys in the Antarctic who found a spaceship, accidentally blew it up.
Yes.
Found a frozen alien, unfroze it, only to find out that it can kill animals and people and change into the forms it absorbs. Where we left off, the gang all suspects that the cosmic ray expert, Connett, might be the thing. Mm-hmm. But they have no way to test him. Also, Blair the biologist, from Facts of Life, thinks that everyone is infected and has gone totally homicidal nuts and wants to kill everybody. Also, the creature may be telepathic.
They've cut themselves off from the outside world because they suspect that the thing may dominate the planet were it to get out of the confines of the Antarctic.
Righto. So MacReady, the second in command, says that the thing's imitations are flawless. It knows everything the person knew, it moves like them, and it thinks like them in a way, because even their brain is duplicated.
Right. It wouldn't be much good if it only looked like a person, because as MacReady says, it would still have a totally unhuman mind. It would be like, "Hello, fellow humans. Hello, Janet. You look pregnant today. Shall we all absorb nutrients from the color yellow now? That's what we do here, right?" It wouldn't work. It would be exposed immediately.
So Conrad is there and getting pretty defensive. He claims that he is himself, but of course, that is what the thing would say if it was pretending to be him.
Or if he didn't even know. I mean, since it absorbs you and then perfectly recreates you. This is a question I don't even know if this came up in the Carpenter adaptation, but would you even know if you were the thing?
Now, would you think you're yourself until you start to change and then you would become the thing?
Yeah.
While you're the imitation, you might actually think that you are who you're pretending to be.
You'd just be continuing to hum along with your human thoughts.
Right. But I think that that's not the case, because later on, we see some stuff.
Right.
MacReady says to Connett that you got it easy. You know if you're an alien or not. Everyone here is scared that you might be a monster. They're scared of you. To which Connett says, "Lord, I wish you could see your eyes. Stop staring, will you? What the hell are you going to do?" So what are they going to do? Doc Copper's got an idea. It's a serum test, and this is what that is.
"If I had a rabbit that had been injected with human blood, a poison to rabbits, of course, as is the blood of any animal save that of another rabbit, and the injections continued in increasing doses for some time, the rabbit would be human immune. If a small quantity of its blood were drawn off, allowed to separate in a test tube, and to the clear serum a bit of human blood were added, there would be a visible reaction, proving the blood was human. If cow or dog blood were added, or any protein material other than that one thing, human blood, no reaction would take place. That would prove definitely."
There's that scientific stuff that Campbell liked to infuse in his stories. Mm-hmm. I actually had to read it a few times to kind of understand what this test was.
But when Andrew read it, it made perfect sense to me.
Absolutely. I understood it perfectly.
They figure they can use one of the dogs instead of a rabbit, and they'll need two human donors. And the process will take several days for the dog's body to get used to the human blood.
Right.
It's decided that they'll use Doc Copper and Commander Gary's blood.
And then they have to figure out what to do with Conant in the meantime. You know, Conant's all indignant because they think he's a monster, but they have good reason to suspect that.
Yeah.
Since he should understand, the monster crept out of the ice right behind you. You escaped. You were the only one there. It seems suspicious. Although, you know, one thing to his credit is if he was lying about it, he probably wouldn't have made up a better story than that he was just incompetent. You know?
Right.
Like, guys, you won't believe the thing busted out of the ice. And I was like, nuh-uh, not on my watch. And I got him in a full Nelson. And he was like, oh, get off me. You're so strong. You're so strong. You got such a good grip on me. And I was like, but the ice was slippery and, you know, he got away. It would have been probably more like that if he was lying. Conant didn't do that.
No.
So he resents them implying that he's a monster.
Conant gets angry, but then Doc gets even angrier. Says, if you are the thing, you're a danger to us all. You're a danger to the whole world. We're going to lock up Blair, who will try and kill you and the dogs and everyone else. So we're going to have to do at least the same for you.
Yeah, if we're locking up a crazy human,
yeah,
we got to at least lock up the suspected alien.
They decide to lock him in his lab, the Cosmos House, which is where he would be anyway. And Conant, he doesn't like it, but he agrees. And he says, I'm human. Hurry that test. Your eyes. Lord, I wish you could see your eyes staring. Gary asks Doc Copper if this thing is going to work. The doc says that normally they would have rabbits for this kind of thing. Dogs are a bit harder to deal with. And rabbits, you could just buy human immune rabbits from labs for this kind of thing.
And they're selling those at CthulhuLives.org right now. Human immune rabbits. If you get the Who Goes There bundle, you get melted seal blubber, some human immune rabbits, and some blood that you probably should not have just touched.
That is not true.
It's all there now.
That would be great, but that is not true. Since the camp has no locks on anything, they have to fit Cosmos House with some bolts on the outside. Somebody brings up how you get rid of hoof and mouth disease. You kill all the cattle infected, and you kill all the cattle that came in contact with it. And Blair knows this, you know, because he's a biologist, so that's probably what he's planning. Blair thinks that if a gull or some other animal comes their way in the summertime, then it's all over.
Clark's lips curled in a twisted grin. Sounds logical to me. If things get too bad, maybe we'd better let Blair get loose. It would save us committing suicide. We might also make something of a vow that if things get bad, we see that that does happen.
Wow.
There's this grim determination here that I think carries over to Carpenter's adaptation.
Yeah.
We might all have to sacrifice ourselves for the benefit of the world. That grim determination is entirely missing from the 50s version. It's yep. mentioned in the dialogue, but that's a Howard Hawks movie, and he directed it even though I think he gave credit to his editor for mm-hmm. the direction, but it's clearly his. And I love Hawks movies. He's always got these great, intelligent, funny female characters who are independent. You know, he did His Girl Friday. That's one of my favorite
right.
movies.
Yeah.
There's a female lead in his version of this, The Thing.
Oh.
And she's got kind of this witty repartee with the captain who's running things. It's really fun. But even when the creature has cut their heat and they're all about to freeze to death and they're trying to wire up the place to electrocute it, but they don't know if they're going to survive, they're still doing banter in that movie. Like, they're still smiling at each other. And it's fun to watch, but it's got this lightness to it where the characters seem to know they're in a movie and, like, nothing too bad is going to happen to them. Whereas the characters in the story, they do have a kind of a wry humor, but they immediately realize, hey, we're all probably not going to make it out of this.
Yeah. Copper says that they've got enough thermite to destroy the whole camp and everyone in it. Gary wonders why it doesn't just make itself into a bird from its own home planet.
Yeah, if it can change into everything, why does it always have to imitate?
And Copper guesses that it might not know how to make a bird that can fly in our atmosphere. But again, he doesn't know. No one knows. And that's why this thing is so scary. It's the fear of the unknown.
And that's really it. All the guesses they've made so far have been entirely wrong.
They decide they're going to put Blair in with Mrs. Garrett in the East Cache. It's a storage room, but they can lock him up safe in there.
Yes, and lock him up alone. There is no Mrs. Garrett, sadly, in this story. But that's what they did to Wilford Brimley in the movie.
It blows me away. I kept reading this going, wow, this is just like the movie. Or the movie is just like the book, obviously.
But. Yeah, we quote that all the time around the house when he tries to pretend he's better later. You know,
yeah.
I'm all right now. I want to come back. Say that all the time. I'm all right now.
Also, they don't want to hear him screaming crazy stuff.
Yeah, good reason to get him out there.
Blair had dreams, like MacReady did, about the thing.
He slept beside the thing when we stopped on the trail coming in from secondary magnetic, remember? He dreamt the thing was alive and dreamt more details. And damn his soul knew it wasn't all dream or had reason to. He knew it had telepathic powers that were stirring vaguely, and that it could not only read minds, but project thoughts. They weren't dreams, you see. They were stray thoughts that thing was broadcasting. The way Blair's broadcasting his thoughts now, a sort of telepathic muttering in its sleep. That's why he knew so much about its powers. I guess you and I, Doc, weren't so sensitive, if you want to believe in telepathy.
So Lovecraftian.
Mm-hmm.
Someone asks about the expedition and what they were going to do about all the work they have to do. Gary says, you know, the whole thing's just a loss. This has kind of put a wrench in our job here.
Right.
But, you know, on the bright side, they did discover alien life, so not a total loss.
No, if they manage to contain it and survive, this could be the greatest discovery of all time.
They all wonder if they're ever going to make it out of there alive and human.
If they all end up infected, they're going to have to stage some kind of fake accident. They talk about that, you know. They don't want curious people to come out and find out what happened and get infected. So some respects, it's kind of like Mountains of Madness. You know, we have to warn people away from being too curious. Barclay says, I was wondering if a nice running account of an eruption or an earthquake via radio with a swell windup by using a stick of Deconite under the microphone would help. Nothing, of course, will entirely keep people out.
Mm.
So they know that even that would only slow things up.
So Chapter 8, they're putting Blair in the East Cache cabin. He insists on only canned food.
And of course, a bowl of steaming Quaker oats.
Yeah, he's got his diabetes.
He's got things.
Yeah, and of course, he won't let anybody near him. They lock him in with cables. They cable the door closed, but then he barricades the door on the other side.
Yeah, fine. I wanted this locked anyway.
So MacReady asks how the dog is doing, and Copper says, well, it's only been 30 hours. We have to wait another 5 days. Mm. So MacReady brings up, why would Conant, if he was the thing, why would he warn them that the thing was gone?
On the one hand, Conant's feelings aren't changed. They're imitated perfectly, or they're his own. Naturally, the imitation, imitating perfectly Conant's feelings, would do exactly what Conant would do, which is a pretty good explanation.
Yeah.
And scary. But the other explanation is the aha moment.
Copper thinks that it might be that they aren't loyal to each other, that they're selfish, that they care only about their own survival.
Which almost makes the thing a little less scary. You know, when you take the unified planning out that these things are working at concert with each other.
Yeah.
But then again, it's only a theory. I think the thing could have assimilated him, Conant, you know, figured out that humans are selfish.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll see their own behavior, you know, in what he does. And then triggered all this paranoia so that they start isolating and infighting all things that are good for the thing.
The men put a rule in place that everyone has to stay in groups of four at all times, which is going to make everyone paranoid and crazy. But Doc points out that the creature should be dead and Conant is the only suspect.
But they have to do it for safety. The paranoia is really kicking in. Benning says,
each of us with an eye on the other to make sure he doesn't do something peculiar. Man... aren't we going to be a trusting bunch? Each man eyeing his neighbors with the grandest exhibition of faith and truth. I'm beginning to know what Conant meant by, I wish you could see your eyes. Every now and then we all have it, I guess. One of you looks around with a sort of, I wonder if the other three are, look. Incidentally, I'm not accepting myself.
Barclay complains that in these close quarters they barely had any privacy before. But now with the four companions at once order... it's just there's no privacy at all.
Mm.
Into Chapter 9.
We jump ahead 6 days, and they are testing Conant's blood. It comes up negative. Conant is human.
And Dr. Copper says that means the thing is truly dead. We got it.
Yeah, all right. So everybody gets all happy. Everyone is relaxing. They're clapping Conant on the back, saying, oh, man, sorry about that. Yeah. He's like, you guys are dicks. But
we knew all along you weren't an alien.
You know, the tension's relieved.
Yeah.
But then MacReady notices that Doc is not doing well and that he is crying quietly. And Doc Copper says to Gary, tissue from the monster precipitates, too. It proves nothing. But the dog was monster immune, too. That one of the two contributing blood, one of us two, you and I, Gary, one of us is a monster.
Oh no! The test proved something else entirely. It also means that Conant could still be the monster.
Yes.
But the test proves nothing.
Gary tells MacReady that he's in command now. Since he's a suspect, he can't be in charge of things. Mm-hmm. Both Copper and Gary say that they know they're humans, but they can't prove it. Doc Copper begins to lose it. He says, it doesn't have to prove one of us is a monster. It doesn't have to prove it at all. Ho ho! If we're all monsters, it works the same. We're all monsters, all of us. Conant and Gary and I, and all of you.
Oh, man. How horrible is it to suspect not only everybody else, but also yourself? I mean, sometimes I wake up and look in the mirror and say, am I a monster?
What?
But that's more of like a metaphorical thing.
Oh, right.
That's because I ruined Santa Claus for all those children.
How many of your nieces and nephews were present during that screening check?
All of them.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Some of them wanted to leave, but I was like, no, there's, you know, wait till they do. I'll go, it's really fun when they get the guy up on the operating table and try and shock him back to life. You guys got to be ready for that part. Oh, the screams.
Oh, golly.
The screams.
Then Wall says to McReady, you were studying to be a doctor before you, you know, got this job. Could you come up with some kind of test?
He's like, wait, for the alien or for the underwear? There are two mysteries unspooling here right now. Let's not forget.
Yeah, McReady says he does have an idea. He does a quick test and somehow figures out that one of them is not a thing. I couldn't quite understand what he did, but he did something.
Yeah, he tested his blood. Well, it basically monster or human precipitates. Doesn't matter which it is.
Yeah.
So they could still both be monsters, or maybe neither of them is, but at least it leads to a discussion.
Van Wall wonders why the monsters haven't killed all of them. And McReady thinks it's because it wants people in reserve. It can't emulate a dead person.
They don't know that again.
Yeah.
Or if it's holding them. Who knows what it's doing?
Now, at this point in the story, I'm starting to feel like, well, they might know things because this creature is telepathic.
True.
So McReady might be picking up on stuff. That makes sense to me.
Right. When they come up with ideas, they didn't come out of thin air, actually.
Right. But earlier, when Blair was making the exact opposite decision, maybe that's what was going on. Maybe the creature was telepathically influencing mm-hmm. him.
Yeah.
That was something I didn't consider until just this very moment.
Again, to say that you're reading telepathic thoughts, that still doesn't mean they're honest thoughts either. So,
right.
You know, it could be manipulating you for a number of reasons.
Kinner asks if he would know if he was a monster. Maybe he is a monster. And McReady, he says, oh no, you would know.
Which he doesn't know if you would know or not.
No, but he's very confident about this fact. And for some reason, everybody believes it.
He's a natural leader. You know, you got to just assert some things to get everybody in line.
McReady, Clark, and Van tell everyone to watch everyone else while they go test the cows and the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 11, they come back. So they took some of the blood from the test dog and we're going to go test the other animals, but they didn't really even have to because once they were going to go test them, they started changing. All the animals were infected and they had to kill them. The test dog is still a real dog.
Oh, man. Yeah, I guess that they ate up on that thing early on in that first dog attack.
Yep.
And they ingested it, so they all started changing. It's crazy all that happened off stage, so to speak, you know?
Yeah.
And the guys are being pretty cool about it. Van Wall says they're very nasty when they start changing, but slow. That electrocution iron you made up, Barclay, is very fast. They look funny as hell when they start melting. The beast hasn't any quick escape when it's tied in dog chains or halters, and it had to be to imitate.
Yeah.
Haha, they killed all the animals. That's good, right?
Kidder brings up the milk that they've been drinking, but McReady tests the milk and it's negative. It seems that they got it before they turned, or alien cows just make regular milk.
Damn GMOs. This is something that never made it to an adaptation, though. This idea that they were consuming or ingesting something produced by the thing.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's rough.
So Conant says the dogs must have ate some of the thing and it infected them and tries to say that that proves that he's not a monster because I was not around when that happened.
Yeah.
But McReady, he's not buying it. He says, we are helpless because we don't know enough and we're so jittery we don't think straight. Locked up. Ever watch a white corpuscle of the blood go through the wall of a blood vessel? No. It sticks out a pseudopod and there it is. On the far side of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Van Wall says they could have melted down, become just a thread of stuff and leaked under a door to recollect on the other side. Ropes? No, that won't do it.
Yeah, assuming because those animals were leashed up. Come on. There are animals in the world we know that can do that, not even on a microscopic level. Obviously, an octopus can change shape to fit through a space as small as a keyhole, but even a mouse can flatten itself to get under a door.
Yeah.
I think these guys that just had to kill all these things, they finally realize what they're actually up against in this moment.
Yeah.
Assumptions all go out the window.
Chapter 12, everyone's keeping busy. They're doing their regular jobs or they're playing some chess, trying not to think about the situation to keep an eye on each other.
By the way, in the Carpenter movie, Adrienne Barbeau is the voice of the chess machine.
Oh.
She's the only woman in the movie. little trivia for
you.
Oh,
yeah. So Kenner has totally lost his marbles and is screaming, praying, crying, making a lot of noise and freaking people out. They want to put him in the Cosmos house, but MacReady says no. It seems Kenner has been freaking out for hours when MacReady was out doing something.
Wait, this is the part, you know, in poorly written space madness scenes where the crazy person starts reciting nursery rhymes for some reason, you know?
Yeah.
The itsy bitsy spider climbed up the water spout.
They have tried to check on Blair, but he's barricaded himself in and they can't open the door. And he's told them that he's fine. He doesn't want him anywhere near him.
I'm not all right now. Leave me alone.
They're doing rotation sleeping, so half the people are awake and the other half are asleep. Van Wall thinks that the humans must have greater numbers because if enough of them were things, they could overpower them. But MacReady says it doesn't fight. I don't think it ever fights. It must be a peaceable thing in its own inimitable way. It never had to, because it always gained its end otherwise. Van Wall says you think it might already have greater numbers, and it's just being real patient.
It's a lover, not a fighter. I mean, I think that's what he's not understanding. Well, in all seriousness, violence is just not how it gets its goals accomplished.
For sure.
Which is kind of an interesting idea that MacReady introduced there. He said it's a peaceable thing in its own way. And that got me thinking, you know, it is sort of how peaceful change does happen in the world on a societal level.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It happens over time as the people with older ideas are systematically replaced by younger people with different ideas. And depending on where you are on that spectrum, it can be either terrifying or exhilarating. You know, when you're the thing, where you start out, yeah, this is awesome. But in the end, when you become a victim of the thing, you know, you become a ranting space mad person who's just made a bunch of mistakes. But I think that's a cool aspect of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't think of that before.
Yeah.
Now, they're all complaining about Kenner and his screaming prayers, and that maybe an axe to the head would prove if he is or is not the thing.
That's like one of the old witchcraft tests. I say we hit her in the head with an axe, and if she dies, she's not a witch.
So MacReady looks around for more canned food, and he tries to figure out his next move. Someone suggests to MacReady that they put on a movie. Since he's in charge, he decides, okay, yeah, they'll do it. Mostly they want to do it to drown out Kenner's screaming and to keep them distracted. Mm-hmm. They keep some of the lights on so that everybody can keep an eye on everybody else, and they play some old cartoons.
I'm sure, just like in the movies, the cartoon is stupidly relevant to their situation, you know, for no reason. Right.
As they watch a cartoon, they notice that Kenner's voice had actually stopped abruptly. And MacReady, he goes, whoa, stop the sound, and he runs to check it out. MacReady comes back and says someone stabbed Kenner in the throat. So there isn't just monsters and madmen, they've got a murderer.
A murder? That's a third mystery. Alien, underwear, murder.
MacReady pulls out the murder weapon. It's a kitchen knife. Clark says that he left it on the stove. They point out that there might be more monsters than they think, and if someone could just kind of slip out unnoticed and then come back.
Yeah.
But Van Wall argues, why would a monster do that? Why decrease its supply? Nope, a regular person did this.
A monster's not just going to stab somebody.
MacReady goes and gets the electrocutor. He and a few others want to go and check on the body. Then they hear some noise and some screaming. Find out Kenner was a thing.
Kenner's arms had developed a queer, scaly fur, and the flesh had twisted. The fingers had shortened, the hand rounded, the fingernails become 3-inch-long things of dull red horn, keened to steel-hard, razor-sharp talons.
Oh, no! So it faked being dead, so much for that theory that it, you know, can't turn into a corpse or something. But when they went to shock it, I think that's when the alien went into preservation mode.
Kenner was alive when it duplicated him. It was that's just true. Playing dead.
Yeah.
So that rule still might be in effect.
That's true.
It can't imitate a dead person. But MacReady says that whoever killed him can come clean because they didn't kill a real person. They killed a monster.
Yeah.
So Norris is freaked out that these things are like master thespians.
Mm-hmm.
Kenner was pretending that he's lost his mind. That whole show, that he's crazy. I'm a crazy person. I'm crazy out of fear. It's like, no, that was a monster pretending to be crazy.
Yeah. Somehow the thing knew that that nursery rhyme trick would work. He knew that what humans perceived as space madness in bad B-movies.
Clark was sitting next to the doorway and he speaks up and he says, you know what? I killed it. MacReady says, boys, meet Clark, the only one we know is human. Meet Clark, the one who proves he's human by trying to commit murder and failing. Will the rest of you please refrain from trying to prove you're human for a while? I think we may have another test.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole thing is giving MacReady an idea. He's got a new test.
Even better than the axe to the head test?
MacReady is counting on the quality of the things and not on humans. That was going to be the giveaway.
Selfish is the word. They must be, you see. Every part is a whole. Every piece is self-sufficient, an animal in itself. Blood is tissue. They have to bleed. That blood separated from them is an individual, a newly formed individual in its own right, just as they split, all of them, from one original are individuals. The blood will not obey. It's a new individual, with all the desire to protect its own life that the original, the main mass from which it was split, has. The blood will live and try to crawl away from a hot needle, say.
Boom, that's the test, yep. And that's the basis of the best, most suspenseful scene in the Carpenter movie.
Yep.
Maybe one of the most suspenseful in all cinema, where everybody's tied to the chairs and they're testing the petri dishes of blood one by one.
So MacReady asks Van Wall to be the first test subject. MacReady cuts his thumb and then collects some blood into a test tube. MacReady heats a platinum wire and then puts it in the blood. Nothing happens. MacReady says, well, my theory hasn't been proven yet, but I think this is going to work. So MacReady has Barkley come over, cuts his thumb. Again, nothing happens. Then Dutton is up next, but whoa, monster out! He changes into a monster. But at this point, everybody's so geared up that they just savagely attack Dutton, the monster. They just get on him and they cut him, they punch him, they shoot him. They, you know, they're going nuts.
Yeah, thank God they weren't tied to chairs. They completely take it out. And then Barkley comes over with the electrocutor and he burns it up. Things smolder and stink. They drop acid on every little piece of blood that tries to get away.
So MacReady does the test and shows he's human. Connett was next, but bam! He turned, attacked, and was defeated. So Connett was a thing.
He was a thing all along.
They do the blood test on Gary, but his blood moves away from the hot wire.
Gary's blood shrank from the hot platinum wire and struggled to escape the tube. Struggled as frantically as a suddenly feral, red-eyed, dissolving imitation of Gary struggled to dodge the snake-tongued weapon Barkley advanced at him, white-faced and sweating.
Mm. Oh man, lots of jump scares happening in that chapter. And that gets us into chapter 14, the final chapter.
They tested everyone, and 14 of them were things.
Yeah.
I wonder why they didn't just all turn, you know, while they were being tested, be like, oh man, we're gonna get busted. We might as well just go, all of us attack at once. But, you know, they're wrapping up the story, I guess, at this point.
And well, also, that's an assumption that they have any kind of social relationships with one another at all. I mean, they could be.
Yeah.
The minute you become an individual organism, you just are kind of doing your own game and they don't, like, team up or anything.
Yeah. Could be. Yeah.
Or they wanted these guys to feel a false sense of closure.
Right. So they thoroughly clean up with acid and they burn everything else. They remember Blair and they're like, oh my God, we left him out there. I wonder if we're going to be able to convince him that we've, you know, got all the things.
Mm.
And when they get to the shack, they see that there's no smoke coming out of the chimney. In the distance, they see an albatross flying, first of the season, and they think, maybe, is that a thing?
Oh no.
So they shoot it once and then twice, and then it drops and they lose sight of it. They get close to the cabin and they hear a humming sound. They cut the wires to the door, and MacReady, he peeks in and says, it's kneeling on something on the bunk, something that keeps lifting. Whatever it's working on is a thing like a knapsack, and it lifts. So Blair is a thing, and he's building something. So they burst into attack.
Like a blue rubber ball, a thing bounced up. One of its four tentacle-like arms looped out like a striking snake. In a seven-tentacled hand, a six-inch pencil of winking, shining metal glinted and swung upward to face them. Its lined, thin lips twitched back from snake fangs in a grin of hate, red eyes blazing. Norris's revolver thundered in the confined space. The hate-washed face twitched in agony, the looping tentacle snatched back. The silvery thing in its hand, a smashed ruin of metal. The seven-tentacled hand became a mass of mangled flesh, oozing greenish-yellow ichor. The revolver thundered three times more. Dark holes drilled each of the three eyes before Norris hurled the empty weapon against its face. The thing screamed in feral hate, a lashing tentacle wiping at blinded eyes. For a moment it crawled on the floor, savage tentacles lashing out, the body twitching. Then it struggled up again, blinded eyes working, boiling hideously, the crushed flesh sloughing away in sodden gobbets.
It grabs Barkley, and he could feel it getting on his skin, biting into it. MacReady corners it, and he burns it to ash. But what about Barkley? Did he get infected?
Yeah, I mean, he was touched by it. It would have been great if MacReady had just turned around and immediately killed Barkley. You know, zombie rules. Sorry.
But it's not addressed in the story. The thing was building something in the shack. It got them to leave it alone while it worked. So it might have been Blair from the very beginning.
It's exactly what was going on in the Carpenter movie.
Yeah.
Brimley was in there building a little spaceship.
And it kind of makes sense because Blair was messing with tissue samples from the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was doing all that testing, his whole, you know, wrecking all the equipment could have been a put on for him to start building his ship, because he knew he can get out of there. He didn't need all that stuff.
Anti-gravity, Norris nodded. Yes, we had him stopped with no planes and no birds. The birds hadn't come, but it had coffee tins and radio parts and glass and the machine shop at night. And a week, a whole week, all to itself. America in a single jump with anti-gravity powered by the atomic energy of matter. We had him stopped. Another half hour. It was just tightening these straps on the device so it could wear it. And we'd have stayed in Antarctica and shot down any moving thing that came from the rest of the world. The Albatross, MacReady said softly. Do you suppose, with this thing almost finished? With that death weapon it held in its hand? No, by the grace of God, who evidently does here very well, even down here, and the margin of half an hour, we keep our world and the planets of the system too. Anti-gravity, you know, and atomic power. Because they came from another sun, a star beyond the stars. They came from a world with a bluer sun.
That's the end of the story.
Yeah, well, that's an assumption that because it had the spaceship, that it wouldn't have converted into the Gull.
Or that the Gull came anywhere near it.
But if their earlier theory was that it was selfish, a separate organism would not be worried about the spaceship, would find its own way out. Or why wouldn't it have a multitude of plans in case it got discovered?
Right? Yeah, it's true.
I mean, I guess the fact that we're not all things now lets me know that they did actually contain the monster.
Or are we? I really enjoyed reading this story. I thought it was lots of fun. It's got some problems with the writing. I wonder if he edited it himself, since he was an editor. Because it feels like some of this stuff could have been pointed out by a good editor. It's like, wait, what's going on here? Who's saying this? You know, like those types of things.
That's a good point. Yeah, probably he didn't have any other person look at it to help him out with those things.
It's still some amazing sci-fi. I mean, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Hey, I want everybody to have a Happy New Year.
Happy New Year!
We hope you all enjoy yourself, and we will be back in January. Actually, the free show for the month of January, we are going to air our 2017 Necronomicon live show from Providence. Backers of the Kickstarter, of course, have already gotten to hear it, but we want to release it for the general public. It's on two August Erleth stories, mm-hmm. The Fisherman of Falcon Point and The Shadow in the Attic. I think it's a pretty good show.
It's a pretty solid show.
And it's about an hour long, so I think you're all going to enjoy that very much. And of course, on that show, we're also gifted to have Andrew Lehman as a guest and a reader.
Oh my God.
As we did for these stories.
Andrew brings to life every single thing that he reads. Gives it depth, gives it meaning, gives it gravitas.
Gravitas. Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us over these two episodes. All right, that's it for the year. Thanks, everybody. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and hope you have a good 2018.
HPPodcraft.com
has produced this record from actual recordings made at sea.